Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, the show's producer. And when I'm not on Pharma Talk Radio, I direct the research and program development at the Conference Forum, and we specialize in covering topics on and around drug development and how to get therapeutics to patients faster. So today's radio show is dedicated to understanding the concept of design thinking. You know, what is it, and why are the Apples and Googles and the Mayo Clinics of the world utilizing design thinking? And how can it be applied to clinical trials? You know, what are the benefits, and how can it really make a difference in driving more efficient and successful clinical trials? So my guests today include Komathi Stem, who is the Strategic Innovation Lead at Genentech Roche. And joining Komathi is Kate Helber and Jen Reichuber, who are the co-founders of the Helber Group. So I'd like to welcome my guests, and let's start with an introduction. Komathi, can you tell us a bit about your background and how you got into design thinking?
Sure. Thank you, Valerie. It's really exciting to be on the show and to really talk about how we can actually accelerate drug development because for patients that are waiting. I actually have a history, or I guess a career of working in operations and medical affairs and even commercial. And over the past 3 years, I stepped out of those traditional functions to work in a strategic innovation department that was tasked with transforming how we develop our drugs at Roche Genentech. And as I went around and talked to people and kind of tried to also leave our industry and go meet other industries and see how they were innovating and evolving their business models, it became apparent to me that, particularly I'm based in San Francisco, so I'm surrounded by Silicon Valley, and it became apparent to me that many of these companies were using a common methodology called design thinking to help them take the mystery out of innovation and to really help them have a methodical way in which they can uncover really exciting ideas that were meaningful to their customers. And I wondered, could we use that same methodology to uncover meaningful solutions for our patients that participate in our trials or our clinicians that work on our trials? So that's how I got started in this whole business.
Thank you, Komathi. And, of course, you really helped the industry understand that this exists for pharma, and you had organized a group and presented at the Disruptive Innovations event last September. And I think I told you that when the Disruptive Innovations event, or DPharm event, ended, we had more people request your presentation than any other presentation straight after the program. So before we even had time to upload these presentations onto the website, people wanted to bring this back to their organization. So thank you for really bringing it forward. And Komathi, I know you worked with Kate and Jen on the presentation, so let me allow Kate and Jen to introduce themselves. So Kate, if you could tell us a little bit about your background and, of course, the Helber Group.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Valerie. It's a pleasure to be here. And yes, we have a background in terms of working in the pharma industry. Personally, myself and Jen have both been working in the industry for 10 to 15 years. I believe Jen longer than that, actually. And she could tell you a little bit about her background. And I've been consulting really with a lot of operational aspects in the industry, a lot with improvement and excellence, a lot with technology integrations, especially optimizing trial performance, and a whole lot of different things to have the entire process end-to-end of a clinical trial work in a much more effective and more empathetic manner. And then I also got introduced to more empathetic aspects really by doing change management and audience concerns and doing a lot of culture and brand work. and then began to apply that when being introduced to design thinking as an approach for innovation for clinical trials. And it seemed like such an obvious fit of bringing together all of the understanding that, you know, I bring in my background from change management and empathy and human behavior, and bringing it into innovating business models, and really all of these untapped different aspects of where we could look for new and interesting innovations in the clinical trial models. And it's been really exciting since then, and that's really what we kind of founded the Helper Group on, was to help support organizations in accelerated disruptive innovation.
Okay, Kay, thank you. Jen?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thanks, Valerie. I'm happy to be here with Komathy and Kate and just share a little bit of my background. I have over 20 years working in clinical trials and drug development. I started as a study coordinator doing HIV trials in San Francisco in the 90s, obviously interacting very closely to patients and their network, their caregivers, their clinician, their principal investigators, and I was a study coordinator there, so part of the ecosystem supporting the patients. And from there, moved into pharma in an operations role and managed some programs, and moved into kind of leading a technology group that was focused on innovating and expediting drug development. I had a passion for trying to look at ways we could expedite drug development and get the drugs to patients faster in an approved environment. And so what were the processes or the technologies that could enable that? So I looked at a lot of new technologies and did new technology assessments with very small vendors and now large vendors such as EDC, and on the IVRS side, your portals, your patient access kind of forums. And I really enjoyed my 10 to 12-year tenure at the biotech and pharma. Took a short time over at a technology company, kind of a small one, Oracle, and worked with them developing out their partnership network and how could we work as partners in a connected way to innovate and to drive innovation in the trial space. So as Kate mentioned, I'm happy to have founded the Helper Group with the intention of being those innovation strategists and consultants into pharma, again, looking at that kind of connected background of bringing together healthcare and life sciences and the tech companies to enable, you know, drugs to patients faster and access to information, et cetera. There's such an ecosystem of ways that we can help our patients, and I have such a personal passion for that.
Okay, thank you, Jen. So you all talked about how design thinking can help, as Komathy said, take the mystery out of innovation and how we can use it to drive innovation in clinical trials. So I want to dig a little deeper, and Komathy, if I can start with you, you know, how would you define design thinking? And if someone said, you know, what is design thinking, could you help us define it?
Sure. I think it starts with defining who your customer really is and taking time to understand them better and empathize with their story or their experience. So in our clinical trials, we tend to historically think of the clinician and the regulator as the customer. And what design thinking does for clinical trials, it starts to help teams reframe that customer around the patient. Because if the patients don't enroll in our trials, there is no game, there is no trial. So ultimately, for clinical trials, we need to do a better job of designing for our end user, which is the patient. And so design thinking allows you to first start with understanding what it's like for that patient. What is their world like with a particular disease? And oftentimes, it's not just that disease. There's all kinds of other things around their life that impacts how, when, and where, and why they would participate in a clinical trial. So once a team starts to understand what that is and what their key challenges and key opportunities are for a patient, then they can start gaining insights in which they can really start reframing what the challenge is really and why patients don't participate in trials or why they do. And once they reframe that question, and that's defining the problem from the patient's perspective, then they now have some really interesting insights in which they can then brainstorm and ideate very creative solutions that then in design thinking, it's not just about brainstorming and coming up with ideas, but they also have a really strong methodology to help you, what they call prototype the ideas and test them very quickly with your end user or co-create these ideas with patients. So when you put it through the process of design thinking, you end up with much more meaningful solutions that have actually been tested and ready for prime time in the clinical trial.
Thank you. So let me bring it over to Kate now. So Kate, I know Komathy touched on some of the steps. I understand there is a real process that you take people through, and can you walk us through that process? I know that there's the step of, you know, how to empathize and define and ideate, prototype, and test, if I'm correct. So let me hand it over to you if you can bring us through just very briefly what that looks like.
Sure. And one thing I just want to also kind of comment on is there are, you know, design thinking, like Komathy said, there's so many different people using it, and there are a few different models and methodologies of design thinking out there, but one of them, which was created by Stanford's Design School, the D Schools one, is the one that we use because it's open source. It's available to anyone. You can look it up on the internet, including all of the documentation that I'm going to talk to you right now about the process, which is what's so great about it, is anyone can kind of learn it, and you can go to YouTube and Google all of these steps of the process and learn it, and that's really quite fantastic. So starting with that, the first step of the process, like you said, is to empathize, so that you really start to look at who are all of the end users. And frequently, people have a tendency sometimes to really minimize who the end users are when they're looking at either their product, when they're looking at the clinical trial. Particularly in clinical trials right now, people have a tendency to look at government regulators, the safety organizations that regulate trials, and then, you know, the medical qualifications or the scientific qualifications to make sure that information passes and it has a level of efficacy. But really, when we start to talk about empathy, we mean looking at the entire ecosystem, caregivers, physicians, healthcare practitioners. So it's really getting into the empathy and, like Komathy said, be in the shoes of and really see and feel the experience of something like a clinical trial from all those different perspectives. That's the first step of the process. And then the second one is define, where you start to take those stories that you get from the empathy and you start to elicit out what are their needs, what are the needs of all of the different end users and all of the different customers. And then you go to insights. You develop insights about them. And this is where some of the magic really happens, which is, you know, we oftentimes want to go from, oh, that's what they need, here's a solution for them, which is not what design thinking is. Design thinking, actually, in the second step, is more about how do you develop insights, things that you never would have thought or seen before about end users. And then you get to reframing that problem statement the way that Komathy was mentioning, which is really starting to look at the problem statement of how do you create something that shows up unexpectedly in someone's world such that it meets their needs. So not so much what's your problem when you start out this process, but what is the problem statement from their perspective? And then the third step is you move to ideate, which is meant to be really a quick speed process where you ideate as many things as humanly possible as quickly as possible, because oftentimes we judge our ideas and we say, no, that's not a good one. So you're really supposed to go through and ideate as many ideas as possible, and then go back and touch base with your customers and the people that you empathized with to see, are you actually coming up with ideas that meet their needs? And then, like Komathy said, you take some of those ideas that look like they start to meet the needs and the insights and the problem statements that you made, and then you move into prototyping, and you do as many quick and dirty prototypes as you possibly can. There's some great examples if you look on YouTube where people talk about the Stanford prototyping process, where teams will work over 6 to 7 weeks and they prototype over 40 things and you don't invest a lot of money in them, and you prototype them quickly and then see if they meet the criteria of success. And then you move into testing, which is once you've actually come up with some prototypes that you really think can actually meet the success criteria of all the different end users, help solve all of the problem statements that you're after, then you move into to testing. So it's really teaching people the process of before you really lock down any conclusions about your solution, or before you lock down and say, yes, this is the solution we're going to invest in and focus on, you're really making sure that it resonates with the breadth of end users that you have in a really complex environment, which clinical trials are. Clinical trials have so many complexities and different people involved with them. That's why we think this process works really well for this, is it puts the process steps in to help you deal with all of those touch points of information before you actually get to solutions, so that you really are coming out with something that is innovative and really does meet multiple people's needs. So those steps in that process, we watch people when we train them and we work with them and we facilitate this with teams. They want to jump ahead. And part of our job is to really bring them back in and help them follow, like you said, the very specific process. It really does garner amazing results if you follow it properly.
Okay, Kate, thank you. So, Jen, I'm listening to Kate go through this process, and from your experience in working with different groups and going into companies and bringing teams through this process, what's the most challenging for the team, or is there a most challenging stage? Testing harder than prototyping, or is it defining the problem? What have you found people in the industry to find most challenging?
You know, I think for me, watching people go through the process, there's two kind of phases where I see people get a little bit tripped up. And to Kate's point, they want to move through it quickly. We are trained as scientists of here's a problem, here's the hypothesis, and we test it, right? And we don't slow down in that process enough to gather those user insights. So I think spending the amount of time we do with empathizing and interviewing our users, the patient, the clinician, the study coordinator, all of those needs, and really starting to theme those needs and those insights during that empathy session can be quite challenging for people who are used to saying, no, I know what my business challenge is. Here are some ideas I have. They're already in ideate, right? So I think pausing them a little bit through the empathize phase can be a bit challenging. And they're like, no, we understand the needs of our patient. That's why we're here. We understand the needs of the clinician. But letting them hear that from that user so that they can design with that user's actual needs and insights is very powerful. I think that then leads into kind of the define, right? Helping them understand that readjusting what their actual problem statement is and delving deeper into it and what are the underlying needs and insights can be incredibly powerful. So I think, as Kate mentioned again, it's just pausing in those initial few steps to move them along can be a bit challenging, I think, for some of the scientific minds that we're working with.
Kamathi, what about in your experience? What have you found to be the most challenging?
Well, I would probably reiterate what Jen said in that reframing the problem from the user's perspective takes some time to get people there, but this methodology actually really gets people to that point to reframe the problem. I think Clay Christensen, who wrote the Innovator's Dilemma, I believe, he talks a lot about so depending on the question you ask will dictate the types of solutions or ideas you get. So if you keep asking the same question, you're going to get the same solution. But if you can come up with 20 different questions from different perspectives around the same problem, you're going to get different solutions. So I think that is definitely a challenging part of the process that can be quite, can deliver some breakthrough ideas. The other part that I see as more difficult is the prototyping. We are used to, as an industry, we're really good at execution. So we tend to have an idea, we develop a really strong project plan around it, and only when we have all the parts in place will we actually move forward and try to execute it. But what design thinking teaches you is to learn through action, to actually design and take different elements of your idea and test those. So they call them leap of faith assumptions. So if your idea is going to be successful, are there, you know, two or three assumptions in there that you could test in isolation in a smaller scaled experiment and actually look to kill it early, like test it really hard? And this is where the scientific thinking comes back in. Try to prove the null on your assumption, but try to do it quickly and simply. A lot of times you don't have to plan a big project to actually get the result of it. So that concept of prototyping and testing very quickly with your end user, whether it's your caregiver or your patient, is a little uncomfortable for people.
Thank you. So Komathy, how do you set up a culture or an environment for design thinking to thrive?
I think in our industry, you do need to help the organization realize that the patient and the payer is becoming more empowered and stronger in the decision-making on the success of a molecule that enters the market. So fundamentally making that paradigm shift that we have empowered patients and they are making a difference, and they're making a difference in decisions. And then second, I think you need to have a senior leadership team grow a culture where you learn through action. So the small iterative prototyping and testing is the way you do business. So for example, let me just play that out. If you are designing for a clinical trial that's starting, I don't know, in December of this year, and you have some interesting ideas, maybe on a mobile app or something that'll be easy for the patient, typically what we would do is we would plan, and then we'd roll it into the trial. But in this case, in the design thinking, we would actually bring a few patients on and work with them to design the mobile app with them, and we would keep testing it. And what we started out with an idea for a mobile app, I could bet you, is probably significantly advanced and evolved by the time it actually enters a trial. So allowing teams to have that space to do some early testing and evolve into the trial versus project plan and start, I think that it's just a different way of doing the work. And that would require some senior leadership willing teams to do that, and probably being willing to accept failure or not the expected outcome as you're doing it, and the willingness to pivot to a different pathway as that happens.
Okay. Komathy, can you hear me? I was having some trouble with my phone.
Yeah, I can hear you great. Thanks.
Oh, good. Okay, excellent. Okay. Thank you for that. I was going to follow up with that with another question. And in fact, if I may point this one to Kate, which is to say, should design thinking as an approach replace scientific thinking?
Oh, great. I think that's a great question, and one that we get a lot. People ask us, which is sort of, okay, once I start to understand design thinking, does this replace the way we've been trained to think? And I think the answer is no, and sometimes yes. And I say that because there are plenty of places in the world, in this industry, where scientific thinking and critical thinking, like Komathy was also sort of stating, which is, in the industry, we invest in things, we invest in big project plans, we bet on things that we know must succeed and are really for sure bets, and that when we do kind of invest in incorporating new things, we really need them to have 90% success rates to be able to happen. Those things will still happen, and scientific thinking will still happen, but design thinking is to be applied when you need reductive thinking and when you need to be able to explore the ideas and the surrounding ecosystem of information in new and different ways, and be able to put in, just like Komathy just said, that ability to fail, the ability to prototype, the ability to sort of move through things quickly. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest challenges for the industry as it moves forward is, where is it appropriate to maintain scientific critical thinking criteria for decision making, and where is it going to be appropriate to apply design thinking and understand that the behaviors around that are very different? And I think that's a lot of where some of the tech companies in Silicon Valley are really much more advanced. It's not so much we have people here who look at them and say, oh, well, they do all design thinking at Apple, or they do all design thinking in that tech company, and that's not an accurate representation either. I think more so they've learned the skill set of when to apply the two different types of thinking. And I think that is going to be one of the largest learning curves for the industry of when is right for which kind. So I think it's a great question.
Okay. So by reframing the problem and helping people think differently, helping them think more creatively with, of course, the end user in mind, this, I imagine, is what drives the innovation. Am I correct in saying that?
I think it uncovers opportunities for innovation as well as ideas to help you come up with solutions. Does that answer your question, Valerie? I'm not sure if I'm getting to it.
Yeah, it does, because what I wanted to do is I wanted to bridge the gap between, you know, when people are listening, okay, design thinking, it's a process that can, you know, help people empathize with the end user. It can help people be far more innovative in finding solutions. I want to find out, you know, how long does that process take? And when you've all been through this, you know, can you share with me some of the outcomes? So maybe we can start with, you know, Komathy. Komathy, I know you've been really pleased with what design thinking has done for your team. And you've been really energized by the outcome. And can you tell us more about that? You know, what has it done for your team? And if you can give us a few examples, that would be great.
Sure. You know, I initially just was playing around with design thinking, and I thought, oh, another nice, consulting tool to use with teams. But I was actually amazed at how teams dramatically shifted their mindset from the beginning of the day to the end of the day. So I can tell you it works, and I'm amazed. Every time I interact with the team, I'm always amazed at how well it works. So an example is we had, I think I presented this at DFARM, you know, we had a team that had been struggling with recruitment in their trial, so this was a rescue situation, and it had been 3 years, they had 120 sites, they were supposed to enroll 150 patients, and by going through the design process and asking patients directly why they weren't, you know, enrolling in the study, they were able to go from recruiting 25 patients over a three-year period, think 20 countries, 120 sites, to enrolling over 100 patients the year after going through the design thinking process. And it was because they really started to think about what are solutions that matter to patients, and they actually started to train their sites on the process, and the sites started approaching the whole trial in a very different way. So I think this fivefold increase in recruitment in just 1 year is amazing. We've had other teams.
Wow.
It was really, really impressive.
That's a real wow. So you've seen the shift in thinking in just 1 day of training.
I'm amazed at how quickly it can shift. I mean, I don't think we quite get into how to do prototyping and testing, and that happens afterwards. So it's really not a one-day process, but being introduced to the concepts and starting to really empathize with your patient and starting to understand what the real problem is gets people working in a completely different way.
Okay, great. Komathy, I'm sorry, I hope I didn't cut you off. I think you were going to give one more example.
I was going to give you another example of another team that I think was designing their trial as defined by the regulators and as trials have always been done in ophthalmology. And by the end of the day, the team got enough data, if you will, or evidence from their patients and enough empathy with the patients and the clinicians to say, you know what, we really need to challenge the agency on this endpoint. It doesn't make sense anymore. It's not meaningful, and there's much better ways to do this. So they actually went back to the agency and pushed on the endpoint, which is really hard for, you know, to get a team to do that. And getting them, working them through a design thinking day actually helped them do that.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. Jen, can you share with us from the training you've been involved thus so far an example of a shift in thinking?
Valerie, I'm sorry. I'm going to have you repeat that question. I couldn't quite hear you.
Oh, no problem. I wanted to ask with the training that you and Kate have been involved in thus so far, can you share with us an example of a shift in thinking?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for repeating there as well. You know, I think that what is really powerful is to watch what happens in terms of people looking at the vortex, right, the intersection point of what's applicable for the human and the business model and the technology, what's possible. So what are your business constraints, what technology is available, and what are the human needs? And if you look at the intersection of those three points, there can be some really innovative solutions, and really helping people kind of lead with that can be incredibly powerful. And we've seen examples, like come with these examples are fantastic. We've also seen where trial teams have modified their drug delivery model, have looked at different outcomes, have different recruitment strategies, have really assessed their schedule of assessments and modified it based on the patient's need or even sometimes the caregiver need, and someone that's working with the patient taking them to those trial sites and making it a bit more feasible to them.
Thank you. And Kate, did you want to add to that?
Sure. I think for me, some of the things that I would add on that I've seen as examples, and really, again, it's that process of the shift, which is where, you know, teams that were very unwilling or rather saw the inclusion of telemedicine or home visits, mobile nurses, or the use of any kind of app to collect any kind of data or information during any part of the process of a protocol, so that, you know, it was sort of an all or nothing, really how a lot of teams were looking at things. And after going through the process, they were really able to make modifications and changes to their protocol so that some of the visits or some of the interactions could be done locally, and they could actually create a more decentralized trial model so that the burden of travel, the burden of going in for testing or for you know, more complicated procedures could be really minimized for people. So therefore, the burden of participation really transformed and shifted a great deal. And again, with that, these teams were able to sort of see their patient recruitment numbers change fairly dramatically. And especially for some trials, one in particular that we saw that had an incredibly high number of patients that were required over a 24-month period of time, where they had to have 100% adherence to medication that was to be taken twice daily or people couldn't be included in the trial. You know, that was a real challenge for the team, and again, they were looking at it very all or nothing, and the design thinking process was able to give them, you know, during this collection period, we could do this by mobile. This we could do with a local physician. This we could do, you know, with a pharmacy, and they were able to really break it apart and didn't compromise any of the safety or the regulatory or any of the endpoints. And made the burden of participation so dramatically less that it really transformed their recruitment. So I think sometimes that's really the beauty of the examples of the design thinking, is it shifts the context just enough that things that are already readily available and working in the world, they're just able to come together in new combinations for the teams, such that, you know, the business model of the trial looks completely different and everyone ends up winning.
Kate, thank you. You bring up an interesting point. You talk about it's really about empathizing with that end user. But historically, pharma regulations have prevented the industry from interacting with patients directly. So is it okay now with design thinking to interact with the patient? How does that work? Kate, if I can start with you on that question.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and we see a lot, which is, you know, people are trained in this industry to sort of have this mental checks and balances system of like, oh, well, I'm not allowed to engage with the patient. When, in fact, you are allowed to actually engage with patients, but inside of particular constraints and ways of engaging with them. And this aspect of empathizing and bringing people in that aren't participating in a trial that's being conducted or anything like that, it really is highly feasible and works quite well. And I think Comacy can also speak to it because we've walked a lot of people through a great deal of discomfort that they were quite sure we couldn't be speaking with patients. So I think that is also a real challenge for people to demystify when you can and when you can't and what are the ground rules for really engaging with this level of empathy.
Yeah, Comacy, what are your thoughts on that question?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things of historical things that have led us to be very shy about interacting with patients. The first thing, particularly in the U.S., since we've done the direct-to-consumer marketing in the pharma space, and we did not do a very good job of it. We actually made a lot of people angry over it. And as a result of that, I think there's a, whenever you say go directly to patients, people's minds in the industry might go to that marketing space that did that. And as a result of that, they get gun-shy. But then the second part is, there's this fear that when we go directly to patients that we are promoting the product already in the clinical trial setting. So this pre-promotional fear that we could get slapped for. But the reality is if we can do it under the same principles that we use right now for advertising for our trials, only it's in a face-to-face interaction, using those same principles to ensure that you're being very clear on what are the risks and benefits of a trial and that you're not indicating that it does work in a particular disease, but more that you want to understand more about their world and how a trial layered on top of it might impact them. I think there's many, many different ways in which you can interact with the patients to do that. But a lot of it is misperceptions and misunderstanding of what the regulations currently are and mixing it up with commercial direct-to-patient or direct-to-consumer promotion activities.
Okay. Is there any downside to the design thinking process, Comathy? Can I start with you?
Ah, great question. The downside, I don't know if it's a downside. There's, you know, you have to commit to the process. And that can be a little bit of an emotional roller coaster sometimes, but you have
okay.
to trust in the process.
Okay.
So,
yeah,
I, you know, I don't know if it's a downside. That's a great question.
Does it make people feel uncomfortable when they're going through the process?
Yes, it can.
Yes.
Okay.
And I call it creative tension. I think it's actually really important to feel uncomfortable to actually get to breakthrough. No pain, no gain.
okay.
Kind of that way.
Okay.
I concur.
Kate, I was going to say, So it can be a little painful. It is a process. It is a commitment. But once people break through and they're able to see things differently, you know, what's the real upside? If you had to sum that up, Jen, let me start with you. What would you say it is?
Oh, I think the real upside is watching teams get to that aha moment. So, you know, they've taken this wicked problem that's ill-defined or tricky, and they've used synthesis and divergent thinking and analysis, and they've come to this aha moment with like, wow, these are the things we can ideate on, and this is how we could prototype it. And watching the energy shift in the room and with the teams as they get to that aha moment can be incredibly powerful. And then watching then the changes and where roadblocks just seem to get knocked down in terms of the hurdles that they'd be facing, they're like, we can talk to the regulators and we can go here and this is what we should do for the patient and here's what the study coordinator needs, and watching all of that come together is just an amazing aha moment and experience.
Okay. Kate, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think just to answer your original question of is there a downside?
Yeah.
The downside is, how do I want to say this? I think in the downside of doing the design thinking process, this is what I think we've all seen, is the front end of it, when you start going through the empathy and the defining and the ideating and all of those kinds of things, you know, everyone initially sort of assumes like, oh my gosh, this is going to be really fun and I'm going to get really great ideas. And exactly as Jen said, you know, we're going to find a way through the roadblocks, and there's all this kind of excitement to get to that freed up space where you start to be able to generate ideas, which does totally happen if you commit to it. But the initial phase, the downside is you start to realize how potentially insensitive you've actually been in the design of your product or your trial currently. You know, so you go through the empathizing first, and then you start to realize, like, wow, we're not meeting the needs of the patients. We're not meeting all of the needs of the physicians. We're not meeting. So there's this sort of awkward period where you get sort of this whole new range of insight and elucidation about all the potential things you could be doing. And that's really where the beauty comes from and the genius comes from. So I think for me, I always say the downside is like you have to kind of go through that first wave of like, oh, maybe we're not doing such an awesome job. Maybe we're not really that sensitive and whatever. And of course not, because the process isn't designed to be right now necessarily. And I think when you could join that with people's deep down passion of really making a difference for patients, it's a little uncomfortable at first. But again, as Tomasi said, that creative tension of, wow, I thought I was already at my edge of, you know, ability. Really what design thinking is shows you, like, you're nowhere close. You have so much more you could do for people. And that's really where the ease of solutions and innovation shows up. So you have to kind of get through that first part. So that's the downside, is the humbling experience of the early stages of design thinking.
Okay, the humbling experience to get to the aha moment. and Tomasi, I want to make sure I give you an opportunity to comment as well. Anything else to add to this? It sounds like an intense but really enlightening process.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to create a day that sounds like super intense. It's a lot of fun. I think people are amazed. First of all, they love interacting with the patients and the clinicians. Many participants on a study team often don't get to get out, or they were in like Jen had been a study coordinator maybe 20 years ago, but haven't been out. They've been working on products for so long. So they love getting back to the clinics or the patients. And then I think secondly, they're always surprised at what they were able to create. I think they find their inner creativity and it comes out and they surprise themselves. So it is a lot of fun too.
Okay, great. I want to first of all thank you all for taking part in today's show, because it's such an exciting topic, and I keep reading about how many companies and hospitals are applying design thinking, and I know the Mayo Clinic has done wonders with the experience for their patients, from the design of their waiting rooms and to how a patient walks through surgery. And so it's popping up everywhere, and it's so nice to see it starting to come into drug development, and that the three of you are helping lead this movement. And for our listeners, Tomasi and Kate and Jen will be gathering with some other industry executives on May 11th and 12th in Boston, and we're running our first course, Applying Design Thinking to Clinical Trials, and for more information on it, you can visit www.theconferenceforum.org. And that concludes our show today. And again, thank you all so, so much for taking part. And have a wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you, Valerie. It was really wonderful to be part of this. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much. We'll see you in May.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.